afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
For advertisement of the week goes to Dr. Michael Moore.
No.
Yeah, because they have this. He's a chiropractor, by the way. Over on Victor and Hartnell. He's on Hartnell. I would look up the address and everything, but it's on my phone in the other room that we're using to connect with our guests. we're having a little challenge today. So anyway, my lower back went out, and they have this thing. It's a decompression table where you kind of get stretched.
Oh, so they put your feet in it and then touch the table?
No, oh. You don't do those. Oh. By the way, that's Kathy Grindstaff. She's our, I was going to do that after, but now that we got a little time here, we might as well talk about it. So you know those things that flip you upside down?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're really bad for you. They cause people to have strokes. That's why they quit using them. Because apparently our arteries and stuff in the top half of our body are thinner than the ones in the bottom half because gravity pushes the blood down there and then it's got to go back up the other way. But when you flip it around, too much pressure.
Boop. Wow.
So they don't do that. You lay down flat and it's kind of like kind of reminded me of a weightlifting belt. A little bit, like a kidney belt that you would wear. So one kind of goes around like your upper torso and one kind of goes around that hip area. And then they set it up based on your height, your weight, you know, what part of the body they're targeting, blah, blah, blah. And it sort of pulls just a little bit, like a little and then lets go and then a little more, holds it for a few seconds, a little less, more, less. And you do this like nine, you can do it as many times as you want, but I had this pinched nerve that made it so that I pretty much swore all the time. It's like I had Tourette's.
So it's not like the Inquisition.
No, it wasn't like, well, it could have been, but it was, but you didn't, the object wasn't to get you to say anything. They wanted me to stop saying things because everything I said was inappropriate. Because I learned, I don't know why with intense pain, screaming out like balloons or confetti or,
I know,
you know, ice cream, it just doesn't relieve the pain, but swearing does. Somehow.
So there's a lot of people in pain.
Yeah. Uh-huh. A lot of swearing. But no, so it kind of builds up and then each time you do it a little bit longer and everybody's probably different a little bit, but, I've done it four times. So last, like a week ago Friday and then Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And, I can walk around and lean over and get in and out of the car and sleep all night and,
a miracle.
It was kind of a miracle, yeah. Really, actually, sort of a miracle.
Cool.
So, if that, wherever you live, you should probably check that out if you're having I'm going to do it on my neck next, as soon as I get this lower back thing squared away. I've never had lower back problems, ever.
Oh.
And it was like, holy cow, is this what people were talking about? The worst!
I never went to a chiropractor till I was rear-ended in a car crash.
Oh.
And I went for my neck, and I tell you what, I was all about it. I was like,
I've been going to the chiropractor since I was like 20.
Oh. Hey guys, your
yes,
your guest is on the phone.
Get out! Don't get out. That's what happened last time. I lied. The wrong thing. Stay on.
Stay put.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Oh man. So we've got chiropractic care covered. Let's move on to. Let's move on to marijuana. Oh my goodness! All right, so hold on here. We got to reconnoiter. We actually have Dr. Stuart Reese on with us today. He is in Australia. I'm not sure which part of Australia. I forget. Oh, Brisbane.
Western Australia.
Yes. So let's see. He's a family physician working in Brisbane, Australia, where he runs a large clinic. With a special interest in the medical treatment of drug addiction. He's interested in both the underlying pathophysiology. Say that several times. Maybe I'll shout that next time my back goes out. Pathophysiology of drug addiction. How drugs work in the body and why they're so destructive to long-term health. And God knows we need more people looking at that. He's also works on the treatment of drug addiction, including its radical cure. So he's got a long-standing interest in cannabinoids, particularly as they relate to genotoxicity. And we're going to talk a lot about that, genotoxicity. That's kind of like the word of the hour. So he sent us a really interesting paper on epigenetic aging, which normally people would be like, what? But you really ought to take a look at it. I've posted it for you on the page for today. Today is June 7th, 2026. And I've linked a previous show with him from December 12th where he talked about the genetic effects of use of cannabis. So I think that this is the, how about the untold story or the dark side? I guess the whole thing is a dark
side.
Well,
yeah, the part that nobody wants to talk about, but it's a fact.
It is a fact. So, Dr. Reese, for the people who didn't read your terrific email you sent us and the research, can you kind of lay this out for them a little bit? And hello.
Hi. Look, I'm calling you on the mobile. Can I try and call you on WhatsApp?
Oh, I thought we already did that. Back to Alex. Back to Alex in the other room.
He's on the hard line.
He's on the hard line.
Oh, he's on the dial.
Oh, is that the line? Oh. Okay, back to Kathy and Bill and Aaron talking about nothing.
I'll call you in a moment, okay?
Okay. Yes. Talking to other parts of the world is... You know, we had a chat one time with a guy who was a tribal leader from Libya living in exile. And he was in a cafe in Egypt, and we chatted with him. I'm like, hey, we pulled that off.
Yeah, you could hear the cars going by.
You could. It was really funny.
It was pretty strange.
We also, hey, Alex, he's actually calling my cell phone. So I don't know what you do with that. Oh, whoops, it stopped. I'm going to need another stretching treatment. Actually, we're all going to need a stretching treatment.
We need a house call.
We need it. Yes, we do. So he uses I'm going to just continue on kind of a little bit with his bio here. He extensively uses advanced space-time statistical analytical techniques and formal techniques of causal interference to analyze not just associations across space and time simultaneously, but also quantitatively to evaluate the evidence for truly causal relationships. So he isn't just, well, let's face it, the medical applications for cannabis are not studied. Well, they have been studied a lot.
Yeah.
And come up with nothing. So that's always like, I had a friend who smoked it and felt better. And
I think they come up with something. It's just nobody wants to talk about it.
You know what? That's a really good idea. So yeah. It isn't that they haven't proven it has no medical validity. It's that
nobody really wants to talk about it. Because you and I know that, you know, all the pro-marijuana people want to say, oh, it cures cancer. Oh, it cures this. It cures that. And there's no proof of that. But yet they don't want to talk about what it does do.
Yeah.
Okay, just to be clear,
I'm back.
He is on the hard line for the rest of the show.
He just said he's back.
Alex, you shouldn't promise things. We should just float them as possibilities.
Yeah, I get you.
Get us all excited. We feel all good about it. All right, so Dr. Reese, we know that marijuana has been studied a lot for medical use, and there's never been a confirmed medical use through a real scientific study that has been proven. On the flip side, your research is showing that not only is there damage in the immediate time period, but the future as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Aaron. It's probably not true to say that there are no trials for cannabis at all. It is has been tried in some forms of resistant pediatric epilepsy, and it is widely recommended for spasm and multiple sclerosis, but obviously that's much less than 1% of the reason that it's used in the general community, because it's certainly used in community people. But you're dead right when you talk about the long-term effects, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. Since I last spoke to you, we've published a textbook on this subject called The Epidemic, 2,500 pages long.
Yikes.
And we've recently just had It goes into these things in great detail. Strongly recommended, Elsevier. It's available on Amazon. And we've recently just had three papers published looking at holes in the heart, and one of them in the Journal of Perinatology, which is a Nature journal. So it's in one of the top families of science journals worldwide. And, yeah, I'd love to talk about the long-term side effects of cannabis today, because that's a vastly under-discussed and not understood issue, which is not given its relevance in the community. So I'd love to just bring you up to speed on some of the things that have been happening and just let your readers, acquaint your readers with what's going on in the research in that area.
Yes, please, because it's been, we have not spoken with you since December of 2021, if you can believe it. And that was,
I'm
positive you've done all sorts of things since then. So, yes, you can feel free to start wherever you'd like. We've got about 4 minutes until we need to take a quick break, but let's go.
Okay. Well, look, before I start talking about the effects of cannabis, I'd like to talk about what's happening with cannabis in the U.S. It's obviously, the cannabis industry call it the fastest industry in the world, which might be correct. There's a survey in the U.S. called the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. They call it the NISDA, which tracks three key indices of cannabis use in the U.S., which use in the last year, use in the last month, and use on most days in the month. Now, that last one's a critical one, because if you're using 20 to 30 days a month, then you're basically a cannabis addict, cannabis-dependent, cannabis use disorder. So that's diagnosing right over DSM-5 right there. And all three curves, when you track them longitudinally, are showing exponential growth. More importantly, they actually show, the three curves all show an uptick in 2007 and about 2017, which is when apparently there were significant regime changes. And if you look at the slopes of the three curves in those three periods, you find that the use in those days, the slope increased 60 times. The use in the last month increased 100 times at the slope of the curve, and the use in the last year increased 12 times. The most days, using on most days, very interesting, that's the cannabis dependency there. The rate of use of Americans who use cannabis on most days of the month increased from 2% in 2007 to 4% in 2017, so it doubled in 10 years, and then about 8% in 2023, so then it doubled in 5 years. And as I said, it's got a non-linear trajectory due to these changes in the regime, in the way cannabis is thought about, presumably in America. If you look at the THC concentration of the cannabis of smoke, the average that's reported across the U.S., this is reported from the University of Mississippi Analytical Lab, that rose from 2%, a national average, 2% to 18%, 2% in the 90s to 18% about 2023, 2024, which is a ninefold rise. The percentage of high potency cannabis in Department of Drug Enforcement Agency rose from 28% 2009 to about 80% in 2023. And the monthly cannabis used in the last month rose from about 6% to about 15%. Now, those three rises I've just mentioned is ninefold, 2.4-fold, and 2.6-fold. Now, if you multiply those together, you find that the U.S. population was exposed to 56 times more cannabinoids in that period. If you multiply the THC concentration by the high potency concentration by the increase in the use most days, the cannabis use disorder, you get 86 times more cannabinoid exposure. This is across the whole country. So what that means is that obviously most Americans don't smoke cannabis yet, but it's everybody's problem. There's nearly 100 times as much exposure of the community to cannabis, and that's a big issue. The next subject I want to just touch on is autism. The CDC Atlanta, Georgia actually maintain four main databases for the rates of autism in the U.S. You've probably heard of that. And two of the databases, Medicaid database, and the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, the ADAM Network, both show an exponential rise over the 30 years of their, 20 or 30 years of their history. Medicaid went up 8%, and the ADAM Network regime went up fivefold, but the Medicaid story is a bit longer than the ADAM Network, so that might be why. So you've got this huge exponential rise in autism that has been in the news, and the president's talked about it. Now, in 2019, we published about autism, and we were worried that it was related to cannabis. And based on data up to 2011, we predicted going forward that the rate of autism in the U.S. under a decriminalized regime would be 293 per 10,000. And as you know, the president was talking about 1 in 31, which is 322. So it just came out a little bit ahead of where we said. But the point was we did it just on the projecting for the exponential growth rate for 14 years from 2011 to 2022. We were pretty much on the money. We estimated 293, and the number came out at 322. And using the same techniques now, you can project that forward, assuming continued exponential growth, to 565 autistic per 10,000 children in 2030 and 881 in 2036. So that's assuming there's no major regime changes. And as you would be aware now, the president is actually talking about that.
Now, well, as I mentioned at the opening, when we have to take a really quick break. When we come back, can you, I realize this involves all sorts of, you know, complex science and stuff, and I know you can't really, you know, build us a house over the radio, but can you explain why the cannabis link would cause autism? Like, what is it that's going on in there for, you know, regular people? I know the science is probably fairly clear, but just so if somebody was going to go out and make that claim, I always think if we don't educate people and allow them to actually go make the case themselves, then we haven't really helped them go spread the word. So maybe we could peel that apart a tiny bit when we come back. Our guest is Dr. Stuart Reese. He's joining us from Australia, which is kind of fun, doing a ton of research on cannabis, and Kathy and Bill and I are learning. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. There's our shout out to Officer Joe, who usually sits in with us. He loves that song. And yeah, that's a much more glamorous version of what it's like to be involved in that industry, I suppose.
Okay, one last little thing I have to shout out is with all the Silver grads we had this year, so 9 high schools in Shasta County, mm-hmm. we had no deaths, no reportable deaths or crashes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, 3 cheers for you.
Yay.
Your program is awesome.
We try.
We'll have to do a little promotional on that here in just a minute. Okay. Dr. Reese, back to you. So why is this why is autism going up with all this? Is it exposure or use or both?
Well, yeah. It's cannabinoids and not just THC, but probably all of them. Look, this question, you could talk all afternoon about it. There's dozens of mechanisms, but there are a few key ones that I want to talk about.
Okay.
Cannabis actually interacts with cells through multiple receptors. There's probably over a dozen receptors. A lot of people have heard of the CB1 and CB2 receptors. There's six TRPV receptors. There's three G-protein coupled receptors. There's an abnormal cannabidiol receptor. There's PPAR alpha and gamma receptors. There's many, many receptors that are involved in transducing the signal of cannabinoids, and they're not just on the cell membrane, they're actually inside the organelles inside the cell. Mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum, have CB1 and CB2 receptors, and they have the full cannabis transduction machinery that transduces the signal from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell cytoplasm and inside the cellular organelles that I mentioned. But there's several key things that I want to talk about, particularly that are relevant. Cannabis damages the genes themselves. It cuts the DNA. It cuts the chromosomes. So it's directly genotoxic. Everybody knows what the DNA looks like. It looks like that spiral helix we've all seen so many times. But it actually carries little switches on the DNA. Because if you think about it, you've got many different cells in your body, but different cells. You've got a heart cell and brain cell and muscle cell and skin cell. The same DNA, but clearly different genes express skin cells, heart, skin genes, heart genes, brain genes. So it must be the different genes that are used, and the genes that are used on the DNA are determined by the software that controls the genes. Now, scientists call that software the epigenome. Epi is upon or after the genome. So it's the software that controls the genes. It actually switches the genes on and off. And what you don't see on most of the spiral helix illustrations that we see is it carries little tiny switches on the DNA, 1 and 2 carbon atoms, methyl groups, single carbon groups, which turn the DNA on and off. The DNA itself is wrapped around 8 proteins called histone proteins. DNA in cell is about 2 meters long, and it's actually rolled up and packed away neatly inside the cell. And the access of the transcription machinery to the genome is controlled by the histones and the epigenetic machinery. So the DNA is coiled up around the histones, and those coils themselves are coiled, so it's super coiled. So the access, if the transcription machinery can't get to the genes, then they can't be transcribed. And obviously the heart cell is using the heart genes, the brain cells using the brain genes, the skin cells using the skin genes, and so on. So the software that controls the genes and gene access is critical, and that's called the epigenome. And it turns out that cannabis has a very heavy epigenetic footprint. So it damages about 20,000-25,000 genes in human cells, and cannabis significantly alters at least half of them, and probably more in some studies. So all the studies looking at the software program, the effect of cannabis on this software programming layer, the epigenome layer, are strongly positive. All of them have very strong signals. The other thing you need to understand is that bodies in general, and the brain and the heart in particular, are actually sort of woven together in 3 dimensions over time, which is 4 dimensions. So the body has, just imagine a weaver's loom. It has a woof and a warp, and it's got chemicals called morphogens, which create the woof and the warp, and cannabis messes up most of those key morphogens. And the morphogens have confusing scientific names like sonic hedgehog and retinoid and bone morphogenetic protein and lots of funny science words like that. But the point is that cannabis mucks up most of the morphogens. So the very framework that the body is being woven together on, that framework itself is bent out of shape. And not only that, but the machinery that writes the epigenome is itself disrupted and perturbed and messed up by cannabis. So the epigenome, the software writes, the epigenome has writers, readers, and erasers. And cannabis mucks up the actual machinery that creates the epigenetic code. So the chaos is chaos. So you have second level chaos, if that makes sense. Cannabis does other things too. The brain is obviously connected to the nerves and muscles and the eyes and everything that makes the body work. So the axons and the way the nerves grow, the axons that grow out of the nerves, have to be guided. And they're guided by molecules called axon guidance molecules, which control the connection of all the cells to each other. And cannabis messes up most of those. So it also damages the energy generation inside cells. Some of you might have heard of mitochondria in biology classes, and cannabis severely messes up the mitochondrial metabolism, which creates, it not only creates all the energy for the cell, and everything that, nearly everything the cell does needs energy, but the genome and the epigenome, the hardware and the software of the genes, is also energy dependent. It needs the energy of the cell, which is usually packaged as ATP, which is mostly produced in the mitochondria, to do stuff. Not only that, but I mentioned the one carbon and two carbon elements, the methyl and acetyl groups, which are the methyls on the DNA, and the methyl and the acetyl groups, the one and two carbon groups, are on the histones that control access to the DNA. They're produced directly by the metabolic machinery. So if the mitochondria that produce the actual the bricks and mortar that go into the epigenome, if that's messed up, then you can see why the wheels fall off out of this. It also has negative effects, cannabinoids also have negative effects on stem cells mostly, and stem cells are obviously what make the body, what make the brain. So if you inhibit stem cell physiology and stem cell division and multiplication, if you inhibit nerve connection, then you're going to mess up brain development. Cannabinoids also, the neurons are connected to each other. They say there's trillions of neurons in the human brain, and each one has 10,000 synapses or connections to the other neurons in the brain. And cannabis messes up that whole connection system. Those synapses, there's a very, very, very complex machinery at each synapse. Each synapse is individually regulated. You know, if you go to the gym and you work out, you get big muscles, then you use it or you lose it, right? That applies to muscles, but it also applies to synapses. And the synapses that have a lot of traffic grow big, and they become giant synapses, and then they can duplicate to increase the traffic across the synapse. But all the complex machinery in each synapse, and if you think of the computational complexity of this, you've got 10,000 synapses in each neuron, each functioning independently and collectively, and it's also collectively upregulated and downregulated for a period of heavy traffic. And then the neurons all fire together, and if cannabis messes up all of that, and it messes up the connection, and it messes up the new stem cell formation, and it messes up the guidance of the neurons, the new neurons that are born, they're called neuroblasts, the baby nerve cells, and then they migrate from the place where they're born, near the ventricles, deep inside the brain, across the cerebral cortex, to form the very complex human cortex. If that whole migration process is messed up, which it is by cannabinoids, then you can see that you couldn't possibly have a normal brain. The same sort of principles apply in the heart, right? The heart is actually put together from six different parts of the embryo when it's developing inside the mother. You know, they've got the primary heart field, the secondary heart field, the lateral heart field, the pre-proepicardium, even the neural crest, which is at the back of the neck. Cells migrate from there into the heart. So you've got a complex choreography, and similarly in the brain development too, is a complex choreography. It's like a dance. It's like an orchestra, a composition. These cells, in a very complicated but carefully timed manner, move together to form the developing human heart. And if you study embryology and how the brain, how the heart, how these other organs are made, it's like watching a sophisticated dance. But all of it is carefully controlled by the genes and the epigenetic information, the epigenome. And if cannabis mucks up the genome, the epigenome, and the morphogen framework that it's built, and axon guidance, and cell division, and cell multiplication, you can see why it messes up embryonic development so egregiously in every organ system.
So is this, once it's done this damage, say an adult who's a user, it's done all this cell damage, is it reversible, or does it repair itself with non-use?
Well, that's a great question, Bill. the answer seems to be, to an extent, yes. As you'd probably expect, if people stop poisoning themselves with some toxin, then they recover. But a lot of the studies are showing that ongoing residual damage. Like there was a, one of the world-leading laboratories in studying the epigenome in cannabis is actually at North Carolina at Duke University. There's a fabulous group who've done lots of hard-hitting research in this area. And they showed that indeed when users stopped and they looked at humans and rats, so they sort of, you know, and looked at the parallels together and the results were essentially similar. They did improve, but some of the changes didn't get better. Like and in fact, what happens with cannabis and it activates these genes is that a lot of the genes that get activated are actually cancer genes. And the cancer genes get activated by the cannabis, and when they stop, they tend to largely settle down. But some of them don't, and some of the ones that don't settle down are actually the genes for ALL and AML, which is acute lymphoid leukemia and acute myeloid leukemia. And what they showed in a very powerful paper in 2021 called Refraining from Use Diminishes Cannabis-Associated Epigenetic Changes in Human Sperm is that overall it does, coming off cannabis improves things, but some of the genes actually get, these two cancer genes, ALL and AML, actually get activated by withdrawal, which actually fits with what we see in epidemiologically. When we look at patterns of disease in populations, we see that the act of being born as a baby to a cannabis-dependent mother, there's a spike in these two leukemias. ALL is the commonest cancer of childhood, and AML is rarer. But the point is the gene cassettes for these leukemias, which the scientists call leukemogenic gene cassettes, actually are activated by birth, by cannabis withdrawal. So whilst it's true that most genes improve, some of the cancer genes actually get activated by withdrawal. And there's a lot of cancer genes get activated epigenetically by the cannabis. And although I'm saying that they tend to improve, which is true, there are also many changes which persist for long term. So the answer, I suppose, in general terms, is that coming off cannabis does improve a lot of these things, but some of the changes persist, be it in cancer activation, which I've mentioned, or in abnormal brain development. So there, that's the answer to that.
Wow.
Believe it or not, we have to take another quick break. But when we come back, I am curious to know, how much use, I know it totally depends on the person, because it's like everyone, but how long do they have to use it before, they hit a tipping point? And is it age dependent? I'm curious on that too. You are listening to We the People. We are discussing things with Dr. Albert Stewart Reese. Sorry, Stewart is his middle name apparently, and he is a family physician working in Brisbane, Australia. So I found a couple doctor songs I thought I'd play for him. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Thought I had you that time.
Went to my family doctor for a pain inside my head. I told him that since you left me, I was feeling like just about dead. Well, doctor, what can you give me? And could it take one or two? Can you tell me just what it's gonna do? Will it save me from what I'm going through? Will it ease the pain? Will it ease the pain? Will it help to pacify my brain?
People wanna know everywhere I go, what can the answer be? I tell them music is the doctor.
There you go. A couple of good doctor songs for you. I was going to add here, so the last little bit of the bio here for anybody who's going, wow, who is this guy? So Dr. Reese was appointed and now reappointed a professor in the School of Psychiatry and Clinical Neurosciences at both the University of Western Australia and Edith Cowan University in recognition of his many contributions which advance our understanding of, here is your $15 word for the day, the toxicopathological, no, God, I had it. You tell them what it is, and the treatment of drug addiction in general, and cannabinoid exposure in particular. What is it? Toxopathological physiology? Can you rattle that off, Dr. Reese?
Toxicopathophysiology. But
of
the other
course.
Word you struggled over
That's what I meant.
Earlier wasn't causal interference, it was causal inference, which is how do you prove that something causes something using, that was the other word you stumbled over earlier.
Yeah, right? So many words. So many words in your world I stumble over. That's why they have me. I'm going to make Kathy and Bill read it next time, actually.
Thank you.
I'm going to sit back and just let them go. I'm going to let you introduce yourself, actually. That's what we'll do. So tell me this. Is this, like, somebody smokes pot in high school in their senior year for a little while and then goes about their life and never does it again?
Yeah.
I mean, how much damage is that versus like lifetime use and all that?
Yeah, well, in general terms, there does seem to be what we call that a dose response relationship. The more, you know, garbage in, garbage out, the more poison you put in your body, the more damage it's going to do. But it's not always the case, and some people are highly sensitive. Some people are actually allergic to it. Like if the neighbor next door is smoking, some people, they get a rash, they get itchy, they get hay fever, their eyes water, and they can't stop scratching, and even their airways can close over. They get an anaphylaxis because somebody down the street is smoking the weed, and they're getting it in the wind coming up. So some people are acutely allergic, and that's well described. The other category of people is people who have been exposed in utero and had kind of a smoking parents or growing up and grew up around it, and their system changes in a way, and they can become not exactly allergic but super sensitive due to the epigenetic reprogramming that happens in their immune system. So the dose response thing is, in general terms, it's what you'd expect. The more you have, the more damage you do, and certainly there's evidence of that in the legal paradigms. The states which have more cannabis exposure have higher rates of autism, higher rates of holes in the heart. So we can actually see that, but sometimes it's not always true, and there are people who are allergic and hypersensitive.
So if somebody, say, never was involved with any of this, but winds up with, I don't know, cancer at the age of 50 or something like that, and they convince them that this is good for them, now what? What do you see on that? I mean, I'm real curious about the age continuum. You said there is an aging factor.
There's use. Because the genotoxicity, aging is not terribly well understood, but the latest science from Harvard and places like that suggests that aging is due to, well, I think there's about a dozen things that are thought to feed into the aging process at the mechanistic level, at the mechanism level. But the key driver is damage to the genome, the epigenome, and the metabolism that actually presents the 1 and 2 carbon fragments that I was talking about to the epigenome. And those three things are closely related, and they're impacted by what's going on in the immune system and all the other 12 things that relate to aging. Feed into that central system. So because it damages the genome, the epigenome, and the metabolome, cannabis accelerates aging right across the field. And this is starting to be studied in great detail. There's a lot of people starting to look at this, and most of these studies are finding that cannabis does accelerate the aging process. Remember I said the epigenome controls the genes. If you think about, you know, you when you were sort of 16 and when you were sort of 66 and when you're 96 one day, the DNA will be the same, but the way that DNA is used is different And obviously the software is shutting down the DNA with age because the software changes. So those epigenetic changes or loss of epigenetic information which cannabis causes, and part of the cause of that is because it causes the DNA breaks, the chromosomal breaks, which force the epigenome to rearrange itself, which is the pro-aging thing. So that's one of the powerful things. And we'll come to this a bit later, but if you think about it, the extent of aging that's produced varies depending on what study you look at and what age you look at. But you could say that for heavy users, in the general population of an age of about 40 or 50, it probably increases about a 50% of the age, the biological age rate, right? So this is an addictive drug. It's doubling. It's growing fast in the U.S. population. If we were to take the whole U.S. adult population and increase their biological age 50%, it's been calculated in an initial way that would about double the health expenditure, right? The U.S. annual GDP is $30 trillion. And currently spent about $5 trillion on health, and it's been calculated in at least a preliminary fashion that increasing the age by 50% would about double the health expenditure. And if you take the people over 60, the age of 60, who over 55 constitutes 30% of the U.S. population, they're responsible for 60% of the health budget, and you increase their biological age by 60%, then again, you're more than doubling the health expenditure each year. So that's pretty frightening. Because, you can add $8 trillion to the health budget every year just by making the population older, which is where this is going. You know, in the industry's own words, it says it's the fastest growing industry in history, which might be correct. But, autism is rising exponentially. Cannabis is holes in the heart, atrial septal defect is rising super exponentially. I said before that the cannabis is rising exponentially. But one of the important, there's two important take-homes in this whole discussion. Firstly is the effects of cannabis on the body are they exponentiate with time, with dose. As the dose in the lab is raised, you get a super exponential response. And that's what you see in a lot of the epidemiology. When we start talking about holes in the heart, which is what we wrote about recently, we actually see that in the epidemiology of the U.S. population as well. So the first point is that the damage is exponentially related. And the second big point is that it's not just it's probably all the cannabinoids, because it's related to something called a levitol, which is the nucleus of the cannabinoids, and all the cannabinoids that you've ever heard of share it. So delta 8, delta 9, delta 10, delta 0, delta 1, delta 11, they all have the levitol nucleus. And cannabidiol and cannabidiol and cannabichromine and cannabinol, they've all got so they're all genotoxic because they've all got the levitol nucleus, and that's the key point. And we are unleashing this genotoxic and epigenotoxic tsunami across our population, which, I'll show you in a minute, when we get on to talking about the holes in the heart. The rate of holes in the heart in the defense force has gone up about 2.4-fold, right? That's in the defense force, right? So, the implications of this stuff are horrific, and that's why autism is rising in the U.S. We've shown, and others have shown now, that cannabis causes autism, not the only cause, but is a major and primary driver. And we've given us to a neurotoxic drug, a drug we know is neurotoxic, to the community and allowed it to become this massive industry. We're actually marketing addiction for profit. We're marketing disease for profit. Mm-hmm. We're marketing aging for profit. We're marketing insanity for profit. All the major mental illnesses, right, anxiety, depression, PTSD, psychosis, schizophrenia, bipolar, suicidal acts and thoughts, and even in America in homicides, a lot of these mass homicides, those people are cannabis positive, they're all related to cannabis. All the major mental illnesses related. So we're actually marketing physical and mental illness for profit, which is the train wreck. And that's why I'm mentioning today, we've mentioned autism already, and hopefully we'll get onto holes in the heart in the near future. But that's why this is important. And even although, in a minute we'll talk about how we know that holes in the heart, atrial septal defect, is growing faster than exponentially in the U.S., and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the point isn't really about autism or holes in the heart. The point is this is where the genotoxicity becomes visible, right? Because we don't have blood tests. There's no blood test you can have for your biological age. You can't go down to your local doctor and say, doctor, give me a blood test. Tell me what my biological age is. That test is coming, but it hasn't been invented yet, right? But the genotox, you know, the cancer takes decades to come out usually unless you're a baby and you're born and, you know, the mechanism that I was talking about before. But with autism and atrial defects, it's visible because a lot of the birth defects, we showed that 44 birth defects in the U.S. are linked with cannabis. And in Europe, our work shows that of the 95 birth defects they track, America, the CDC track about 66 birth defects, but the list has changed over time, but 44 of those you found to be linked. And in Europe, they track 95 in Europe, and we found that 89 of them could be linked to cannabis. But all of that sort of babies are out there. But a lot of this stuff is the pre-cancer changes that happens in cells, the activation of cancer gene cassettes that you can't see. There's no obvious blood test. And the aging is a really big one that is most concerning and is the really big ticket number in terms of the health budget. You can't see it. But with autism and atrial defect, you can see it. And that's what's worrying us so much about this, is that we've got an exponentially growing autism epidemic. We've got a hyper-exponentially growing atrial defect epidemic, which all indicates, because we understand enough about, of course we don't know all these things, that's why science is ongoing, but what we know is this will drive aging, and so we are doing terrible things to our community, and it's the ultimate business model, right? Because the cannabis industry gets the revenue from it, and the government picks up the tab for the law and order, for the mental health, for the unemployability, for the tent cities, for all the medical costs. It's just a crazy business model, and they talk about the taxes that, taxes that they're going to get from testing the system. But if you're talking about doubling the whole health expenditure through aging, then you're not even close. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and then you swing over to the part where, it's harmless. It's better than pharmaceuticals. It's natural.
God's plan.
God's plan. I love that. I like that one too. And just to be clear, it doesn't matter if you put it in, like, edible candy, smoke it, vape it. It doesn't matter the way that it's taken in, correct?
Correct. That's right, Aaron. Look, I was just thinking about all of this, and I was thinking about snake oil. Because you know how cannabis is alleged to fix everything.
Oh, right, right.
These days, as you said before, there's critical trials for just one or two indications, but obviously the industry's way outgrown that. I searched out what happened, how did snake oil get turned around, and what justified it. And the snake oil stuff was found to be full of opiates and alcohol, up to 40% alcohol, opiates, cannabis, and morphine, all this stuff. And that's why it was working. Eventually it got put away. But the justification is exactly the same as we're here today.
Right, yeah. We've already seen this.
The snake oil thing, this was the U.S. in the late 19th century, right? It stopped about 1910. But people said, people have a right to choose. Government shouldn't interfere. Traditional remedies are being suppressed. Scientific authorities are biased. It's all the same stuff we're here today. And it's just a clone 100 years later. You know, snake oil was supposed to cure everything. Well, I suppose it's full of alcohol and opium, it probably did in a way.
Because you couldn't tell.
If you're stoned, it doesn't matter, right?
Right.
But it's the same thing now. There's no clinical trials for the 100 or so indications. And it's way overblown. And the thing is a cultural phenomenon of its own right. There is so much evidence of the stuff that I'm talking about. To actually reject it, you have to reject science itself in the name of personal freedom and personal hedonism. And that's the issue, but I mean the NIH, I don't know what the budget for the NIH is, but it's pretty big. But if we're not going to take any notice of science, then what are we doing science for, right? Because, you know, like I said, we were able to forecast 14 years in advance what the rate of U.S. autism was, and you know, you blew through that. You know, we calculated 293 for 10,000, and the U.S. came in at 322 in 2022.
Oh my gosh, hold that thought. We are talking about the hole in the heart situation and all of that with Dr. Reese. I hope that you'll take the time to take a look at some of the information he has sent us with links. You can find that on our page June 7th, 2026, or just click on the POT tab at the top of We the People Radio.
.us.